This is an ABC podcast.
Well, good morning from Australia. I'm very pleased to join two great friends of freedom and of Australia.
At 7 a.m. Canberra time yesterday, Scott Morrison stood up for an announcement that was worth getting up early for. And many, many time zones away in London and in Washington, Boris Johnson and Joe Biden seemed happy to be joining him too. And the topic of this virtual summit really couldn't have been more serious.
I'm honoured today to be joined by two of America's closest allies, Australia and the United Kingdom, to launch a new phase of the trilateral security cooperation among our country.
We're opening a new chapter in our friendship, and the first task of this partnership will be to help Australia acquire a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines, emphasising, of course, that the submarines in question will be powered by nuclear reactors, not armed with nuclear weapons.
Now, that announcement is probably the most significant change to Australia's defence policy in decades. And it comes after more than a year of secret talks between Australia, the UK and the US. The question is, why does Australia need nuclear-powered submarines? And what could it cost us in terms of dollars, diplomatic relationships and potentially lives? I'm Angela Boispierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley. And today on The Signal, the ABC's foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts on what Australia has just agreed to and where it might lead.
So we're going to start in the obvious place and get you to just explain the basics of what we know about this deal so far. What is it that Australia and the UK and the US have agreed to?
So Australia is now going to basically build its own fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Now, we're going to do that over an uncertain time frame. The rough sort of guide that we've been given is that they want the first boat in the water, you know, within a decade, so in the early part of the 2030s, mm-hmm. And that we will rely pretty heavily on US and UK technology and know-how in order to get it done. Now, there are huge questions here still. You know, exactly, you know, what are the conditions of that technology transfer? How much will these submarines cost? We know they're going to be more expensive than the French ones that we've ditched, but we don't know how much more expensive. How will those technology transfers work? What sort of personnel will be taken from the US and the UK and taken to South Australia to help with this build? You know, exactly how are we going to hammer out the contracts? How are we going to manage some of the safety issues around the nuclear technology being used? All of these questions are yet to be answered, but the broad brushstrokes have been laid down by the Prime Minister, and basically we're ditching the French boats, we're going with our own nuclear-powered subs, and we're going to do it with British and American know-how.
And so, friends, AUKUS is born, a new enhanced trilateral security partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States. AUKUS, a partnership where our technology, our scientists, our industry, our defence forces are all working together to deliver a safer and more secure region that ultimately benefits all.
And nuclear-powered subs, like worldwide, are kind of rare, right?
Yeah, there's only a small number of nations. I'd have to check how many. I think it's about 6 or 7 with nuclear-powered submarines. And it's worth emphasising, this is not nuclear-armed submarines. There are nuclear-armed submarines out there, you know, subs that are capable of launching nuclear missiles. They exist. We don't own them. We're not proposing to develop that capability. We don't have the technological know-how, and we're not trying to get it. What we're talking about is basically submarines that are powered by a nuclear rod.
So granted, we're not going to be building subs that carry around nuclear weapons, but there still is a kind of added sensitivity there, isn't there? So much so that we have heard from New Zealand, they've reacted to this already, yeah?
Yeah, so New Zealand has already said that it won't let those Australian subs, when they do become a reality, which is, you know, obviously still at least a decade away, but that they won't be allowed in New Zealand's waters.
The centrepiece of this arrangement is the building of nuclear-powered submarines to be based out of Australia. And Prime Minister Morrison, and indeed all partners, are very well versed and understand our position on nuclear-powered vessels and also nuclear weapons. That, of course, means that they well understood our likely position on the establishment of nuclear-powered submarines and their use in the region.
Now, that's not surprising because New Zealand has a long-standing policy, which is not to allow any nuclear-powered vessels, submarine or otherwise, into its waters. That was struck back in the 80s, I think, and it's all it's saying really today is that it's going to maintain that policy. Australian subs won't be exempt from that policy. So that's what New Zealand has said so far, but it will be interesting to track the responses from other regional nations as well.
Now, Stephen, you said that there are all these questions still about cost, about how this protected information around nuclear power for submarines is going to be exchanged, and also like the time scale. We're talking, though, presumably quite a long time scale before anything built in Australia is actually operational, right? And also, what, like tens of billions of dollars? What's the sort of figure there?
So we don't have a ballpark figure yet, but put it this way. The French contract was $90 billion. That's just to build. That wasn't including the money that we have to spend to sustain the things. That was going to be a lot more. We have been told that these submarines will be more expensive, quite a lot more expensive potentially. Now, I simply don't know what the price tag will be. That's something that's going to have to be hammered out over the next 18 months between the US, the UK and Australia. But the government is clearly expecting that the price tag will be quite a bit over that $90 billion. So this is going to be a phenomenally expensive project. The cost was eye-watering even with the French proposal with conventional submarines. This is going to cost a lot of money. And on top of that, there's already quite a bit of money that's been poured down the drain with this project. Some $2.4 billion has been spent on the French submarines already. Mm. It's probably going to cost us another $400 million or so. That's the rough estimate to break this contract. So Australian taxpayers will be on the hook for $3 billion or before we even begin work on negotiating a contract with the Americans.
Now, on top of all those questions about the cost, which, as Stephen says, is going to be fairly astronomical, there's also the incredibly awkward fact that this announcement comes at a time when Australia already has a submarine building contract locked in, this one with France. It's something that the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, raised yesterday.
We know that the cost up to now has been up to $4 billion. We know there are contracts in place already that will be breached, and we know there will be substantial compensation costs payable. And Australian taxpayers are entitled to know, given that under this government, they began with arrangements with Japan, then arrangements with France, and now we have these arrangements with the United States and potentially the UK as well.
How is France taking it?
Poorly, in brief, really poorly. Unsurprisingly, look, this was a big deal for the French. Not only is it a lot of money that was being poured into a French company, sustaining quite a lot of work in France with a lot of jobs, but it was also seen as a statement of strategic trust between Australia and France. And it really did buttress, if you like, the relationship between the two countries when it was announced. So unsurprisingly, they've responded really angrily. The French Foreign Ministry or Foreign Minister and Defence Minister have put out a statement essentially calling it a breach of trust from Australia. Interestingly, their language when it came to the US was even more embittered. They basically said that the US had frozen France out of a crucial partnership in the Indo-Pacific at the same time that it was trying to draw more European powers into the region as part of a sort of regional balancing coalition with China at the front. And they say that the US policy is, in their words, incoherent. So there's real fury in Paris, but it's not just directed at Australia, it's directed at Washington as well.
What were the circumstances around that deal with France, and what happens now given this sort of pretty awkward end to the deal that was struck, you know, not that long ago in the scheme of things?
Yeah, well, look, it was just constant delays and blowouts. Now, I am not an expert on exactly what went wrong in this entire project. I haven't tracked it as closely as some of my colleagues, but what we do know is that timelines kept on slipping and that the price tag kept on expanding.
The ABC is reporting that the next generation of submarines could arrive late.
The government is rejecting reports that our new submarines could arrive late and cost more than expected.
The government offered the French shipbuilder 25% more money to build the ships.
Well, the story is completely false. There is nothing true about that story.
Now, blame can be put around everywhere. The French have said previously that it was unrealistic demands that the Australians made about domestic work on the submarines, that the Australian government kept on making unrealistic demands about the amount of work that should be done or kept in Adelaide as opposed to in Cherbourg in France. People in the Australian government have complained that the French were driving too hard a bargain and weren't behaving like a business that had been handed, you know, several tens of billions of dollars to put a project together, and that they hadn't been accommodating enough to Australia. I honestly don't know I can't pick through the entrails well enough because I don't know the inside story of that well enough to give you a really detailed answer, but what's clear is that it was not on track. Both sides were deeply unhappy, and in the end, the Australian government decided it would just pull the plug.
And when we put together side by side what it was that the French had promised to build for us and what it is that we're now expecting to get from this deal with the UK and particularly the US, how do those two end products measure up? I mean, what is so much better about a nuclear sub and these particular ones that we're expecting to build?
It's hard to measure them up in a really detailed way because we still don't really know what this new nuclear submarine will be exactly, whereas we do have a fairly good idea of what the 12 conventional submarines that the French were going to build for us were going to look like. But the main difference in the broad is that they've just got much greater, nuclear-powered subs have much greater endurance. A nuclear sub is really limited only by how long the crew can bear staying underwater without going completely insane. They've got far greater range, they don't have to come up for air, whereas every so often a conventional sub does. So that range and the uncertainty that it injects in the minds of enemies and enemy defence planners is what's so useful about the nuclear option. And that's why Australia, when it found out that it could get the technology, that it could take that option, unlike 6 years ago, decided it had to take the chance.
Let's talk about that particular change, because at the time that we did this deal with the French, this company in France, which is majority owned by the French government, our other options were not nuclear powered at the time either, right? There was a possible deal with Japan, a possible deal with a German
That's
company.
Right. All conventional. That's right.
So why have the Americans decided to share this intelligence, share this ability with us in the same way that they did with the Brits in the 50s? Why now?
Really good question. I don't know for sure, but I think, or I suspect, that a lot of it has to do with their growing anxiety about China's meteoric rise, its enormously expanding military capacity, a desire to arm very trusted partners with the sort of submarines, in this case, that can be used to push back against that growing military might. I think there's also potentially a bit of a tacit expectation here. This is in a sense, it's a gift to Australia because the United States is handing over technology, which is very closely guarded. That's a precious bit of IP. So that's a gift to Australia. But it comes, I think, hand in glove with an expectation. And that expectation is that Australia is going to do more heavy lifting, not just through spending the vast amounts of money that we're going to have to spend to actually get this capability, but also to invest more in defence more broadly in order to help buttress regional efforts to balance China. I think that's the unspoken or perhaps whispered sort of quid pro quo here. And look, Australia has said it's going to spend up to at least 2% of its GDP on defence. But there is now, in the wake of this announcement, and not just because the subs will be so expensive, there's now a broad expectation that that figure is going to rise. Some people are saying that you could have, that Australia may well now have to spend 3 or even 4%. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it does increasingly look like, and the government is sending very clear signals, that 2% by itself is not going to cut it anymore, and that they are convinced that that figure is going to have to go up substantially. That's going to be a lot of money.
As you said, China is the sort of the elephant in the room here. I mean, what is the reaction from China so far, and what kinds of hypothetical acts of belligerence from China down the road are we, and the US and the UK by extension as well, trying to, you know, protect themselves from?
First part is easier enough to answer. Second part is hard, because forecasting that sort of stuff is hard. And honestly, even military experts who really know these matters inside out are hesitant to really forecast too much on this stuff. But look, on the response so far all we've got is a fairly predictable statement accusing Australia, the UK and Washington of harbouring a Cold War mentality. That's an ideological prejudice. They're phrases that are trotted out very regularly. China is not taking it well, and it will inevitably see this, not without some reason, as a broader coalition that's being formed to balance it.
If you take the view that critics have here, which is that this is an act that is not necessarily just a defensive manoeuvre and risks being viewed as hawkish by China. What else could we have done? What were there alternative options for Australia here?
Oh, I mean, they could have absolutely, in terms of the nuclear submarines, they could have stuck with the conventional option. They could have tried to get the French deal back on track. I think it was in real trouble for many reasons. They could have potentially tried to negotiate with other partners, gone back to the Germans or the Japanese. It was not inevitable that even if they did decide that the French deal had to be ditched, it was by no means inevitable that they go with the nuclear option, no pun intended. But they have, for the reasons that we've laid out. The question around hawkishness, etc., is always going to be a difficult one to resolve. It really depends on how you view Beijing's military build-up and how you view Beijing's actions in places like the South China Sea. Those who are a bit more hawkish say, look, there's a clear pattern of aggression that we're seeing from Beijing, and it's only responsible for countries like the US and Australia to suspect the worst and to build up capabilities that might dissuade the Chinese from behaving in a hostile manner. Others who are less hawkish would say that we're misreading China's intentions and that they're hawkish or aggressive only very close to home in parts of the South China Sea, the East China Sea and Taiwan that they regard as their national territory rather than any sort of threats that are being mounted more broadly. Look, you could spend hours debating that back and forth, but Australia's clearly arrived at a decision point.
That is The Signal for today and for this week. We'll be back right here in your podcast feed at the same time on Monday. We'll catch you then. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.